there's so much about Fight Island that's intriguing, and I think one of the more intriguing things is kind of the newest news on it, that the UFC is having all its expenses paid by the Abu Dhabi government to do this at Fight Island. Do you think there is a direct correlation to that savings and then finally just ponying up and paying Jorge Masvidal?
Yeah, I mean, there probably has to be, right? If this was at the apex, it's not that we can declare that Jorge wouldn't have gotten his way. I don't think that's quite true. But obviously, if the Abu Dhabi government is paying for logistics and travel and food and all of the medical protocol and God knows what else, plus they're paying a site fee on top of that as an advertisement so that people go to Abu Dhabi when options are available for international travel, you know, they're going to want biggest bang for their buck. And three title fights was great, but one fell out. So they had to, like, put another one together. There wasn't really anybody else that you could even pick from. And, oh, by the way, the best available replacement might just be the second most popular guy in all of the UFC, maybe right behind Conor McGregor. So, yeah, I think the tendency is there that because they were, you know, listen, the UFC has complained that they haven't been able to, you know, draw a gate. That is obviously a legitimate complaint. But if you're not spending a dime, really, to go to Fight Island, and you're getting a site fee on top and they want their money's worth, seems like all parties win here.
Yes, this is going to be a very interesting advertisement over the next 4 weeks for the Abu Dhabi Tourism Department. But it is interesting to look at it through the lens of Jorge Masvidal, who is stepping in on short notice, obviously, to fight Kamaru Usman. Does this mean that Masvidal's holdout worked? Is this just a case of circumstance? Is there a model here for other UFC fighters who are looking to up their pay, or could this never be recreated again?
I wouldn't say couldn't ever be recreated, but I am less inclined to argue it's a model. I mean, you just have to understand just basically how the UFC works with virtually everything. They don't like to be leveraged, right? So let me give you an example. If you fight out your contract as a UFC fighter, it's not to say that if you win your last fight, right? Maybe you won all the fights in your contract. Let's say you won all four of the fights and you didn't negotiate. Usually they negotiate at the right before you have your last one. And you didn't. You held out, right, so to improve your leveraging power. It's not to say that you won't get a better deal the second time around. But the reality is if you took your talents to Bellator and they made an offer, right, the UFC has an opportunity to match. The UFC's never matched. They have never even attempted to match what anyone has tried to get from Bellator, even though they have the contractual opportunity to do that, because they don't want to play that game. They don't ever want to be in a position where they have to set a precedent where they get leveraged, which means the next person can then leverage them and so on and so forth. So Jorge really kind of, I'm not going to say got lucky, but maybe a little bit, which is to say he stuck to his guns, okay, and then disaster struck at basically the 11th hour. And as we indicated, there were some other financial resources that made some bending on this possible. But, like, do I think if John Jones just sits out, he's going to get the kind of raise that I think he's entitled to? No. I mean, when the fighters complain that they don't make enough money, their arguments are basically airtight. You cannot make a good argument that they are paid sufficiently or what they are owed. But what you can argue is, what's the best way to get there? It worked out for Jorge this time, but as a model, I don't think sitting out does anything other than kill your prime. So good for Jorge, but I don't think this is the thing we're going to see a whole lot more of.
Yeah, it took a bunch of different things, including positive tests and, you know, an international pandemic. But he signed up for the fight, and despite the lack of prep time, we're going to see it this weekend. How do you think the lack of prep time for both of these fighters facing each other? We've known that they've wanted to do it for a long time, but how will the fact that, you know, this has come together so late actually manifest itself in the fight?
I'm not of the belief that this is a major factor. And when I say major, I mean, like, all things being otherwise equal, is this the reason why he might win or lose? I don't view it as that kind of a relevant consideration. And I'll tell you why, which is, one, as you guys know, probably Jorge Masvidal is the most senior fighter to ever get a title shot. This will be his 49th fight. No one's ever been that deep into their career before getting a UFC title shot. Been a pro for 16 years. So part of this is just, you know, he understands exactly what he is able to do and how to do it. The other part was he was really training for this, right? I mean, when they were still negotiating, because remember, back before the pandemic hit, this was supposed to be International Fight Week, and they had already penciled in, UFC did, long time ago, that it was going to be Usman and Masvidal. And so that was what he was planning for. He had flown in three-time national champion wrestler out of Penn State, Bo Nickel, as one of his top training partners. Now, maybe he sort of pumped the brakes when the fight fell through and they went with Gilbert Burns. Okay, but even if you listen to Dustin Poirier, he was saying he was still training during that time, maybe not like quite as hardcore. So I think there's some scrambling that he's probably doing last minute, both in terms of the weight cutting and everything else. But the reality is I think he's going to be prepared and ready to go, and I really don't see that as much of an issue.
So as you mentioned, Jorge Masvidal has been training for Kamaru Usman, but Kamaru Usman hasn't necessarily been training for Jorge Masvidal. He's been training for Gilbert Burns. And when you look at what Kamaru had to go through over the last 7 to 10 days, flying around between Florida and Las Vegas and getting multiple tests, and then having to fly to the other side of the planet to take a short notice fight that is going to be contested at 9 a.m. in the morning local time against an opponent he hasn't been training for, with his belt on the line, and everything that comes with that. Can you just explain to me what has incentivized Kamaru Usman to even accept these circumstances?
I think there's just a lot of peer pressure in MMA. You know, if he were to say no, we all saw what happened. It was at UFC 151 when Dana White called Greg Jackson a sport killer, and John Jones didn't want to take on Chael Sonnen on short notice. I mean, the funny part is that kind of stuff happens in boxing all the time, because those guys have a pretty, you know, relatively speaking, pretty strong degree of power and relevance. Sometimes they're co-promoters if it's like a high-level guy like Canelo or something like that. So if this was boxing, you'd probably just lose the fight altogether. But in MMA, there's just this culture of, oh, what's the challenge? Doesn't matter. Oh, how much am I being underpaid? I'll show you how much I love it. Oh, I have to jump through all these hoops? Only the weak-minded couldn't do it. There's just real, you know, Horatio Algerism that runs through the blood of most high-level MMA fighters. And the other part I would say here is, I mean, I still think Usman likes his chances. You're right. This is not the same fight as it is with Gilbert Melendez. You mean Gilbert Burns. Burns and Masvidal, they are very well-rounded, both of them. But Burns has that difference on the ground where I thought this fight would have been much more of a stand-up affair. Kamaru, I don't think, wants to stand too long with Jorge. So I think we'll go back to his bread and butter, which is the wrestling. Is he in shape for that? I suspect he probably is. But between the peer pressure and everything else, you say no to something like this, and it will stain you with the letter A on your clothes for the rest of your life. So you just said yes.
Talking to Luke Thomas, so Arden just referenced it. Like, that fight is likely at 9 in the morning Abu Dhabi time, but the main card's going to start at 6 a.m. Abu Dhabi time. So I don't know what the plan is for the guys traveling there. Do you just stay on North American time, whatever? But yeah, there's a little thing called circadian rhythms too. Like, it's going to be totally bizarre. Do you think that factors in at all, or am I making too big a deal of that?
No, I think it's going to factor. It's just hard to know exactly when and where. But if we do the math on that, if the main card starts at 6 a.m. local time, that means the event starts at 2 a.m. local time. So, you know, you're in the prelim card, you're fighting at 3:45 in the morning. I mean, that's just bananas. I don't know exactly how that couldn't impact at least somebody in some way. And this is, again, the same thing. It's like, dude, if there was a fighter union, it would have been like, there's no way we're doing this. And, in fact, the last two times they went to Abu Dhabi, remember, they held it at a normal time by Abu Dhabi standards, so like they're 10 p.m.-ish, and it ended up being an afternoon card, of course, the last one being Khabib versus Dustin Poirier. I guess they really want to maximize pay-per-view times, so they're putting it at a time where it is convenient for North American pay-per-view buying audiences, which I get, but it's like, if you're going to do that, shouldn't the fighters get a little extra compensation for it? I mean, you're fighting at 3 in the effing morning, for crying out loud. You have to fly all across the globe and have to stick swabs into your brain to test for COVID. I mean, it's just there's all of these hoops they've had to jump through. So, again, though, fighters are just like this, man. Like, oh, what's the challenge? Oh, only a weak-minded person couldn't handle it. I'm not that person, so I'll be just fine. They never complain.
If we can touch on one of the other title fights on this card, Peter Yan versus Jose Aldo for the bantamweight title, which is vacated by Henry Cejudo. I understand Peter Yan being in this fight. You know, he's got wins over Jimmy Rivera and Uriah Faber recently. I'm not so sure about Jose Aldo coming off of two losses being this fight fighting for a title. How did we get here where Jose Aldo at the age of 33 or 34 by now, I assume, fighting for a bantamweight title off two losses?
Yeah, the thing is, though, he's 33, 34 in, like, dog years, you know what I mean? Like, he's got much more mileage than the numeracy would indicate. I can't make a strong argument for Aldo being here. I mean, I think here's what basically happened. He had a very close fight with Marlon Moraes. You could have argued he won, but matter-of-factly, he did not. And then Henry Cejudo was still the champion, and he was like, I want to fight Aldo. And the UFC said, you know what? Let's just do that one because we'll probably make more money doing that, I suspect. And then the pandemic hit, and Aldo couldn't get here. So ultimately, Cejudo ended up fighting Dominic Cruz and then retired. But if you're Aldo, the UFC had promised you a title shot. My hunch is that because they had promised him that, they just kept it going. Plus, the interesting part about the bantamweight division is it's got all of these, like, up-and-comers, man. Where, you know, even if Peter Yan wins this weekend, for crying out loud, I don't know how long he's going to hold that belt because it is nothing but mutants that he has to fight on his way down the list there. So probably what they wanted to do was, hey, we'll use whatever name value Aldo has to buoy Peter Yan if he wins. And if not, and Aldo wins, which I don't think he will, but it's not totally out of the question. You know, he becomes a two-weight world champion, Hall of Fame material. If he wasn't already, that would absolutely solidify it. So I can sort of, like, squint and get the business reason. But if you're asking, like, from a fight perspective, how did he get this fight? You know, matchmaking gerrymandering is basically what I would call it.
And then the other title fight, obviously, Max Holloway and Alexander Volkanovski. And I think, you know, MMA fans are learning a lot about how prepared and talented Volkanovski is coming out of City Kickboxing. Like, all of the fighters who come out of there, very intelligent game plans and very well prepared and great ideas of how to win fights. But I'm almost more interested in what Max Holloway looks like this weekend and whether he looks like the Max Holloway we've all come to know and expect over his title reign, or if it's possible that we're now sort of watching the decline of Max Holloway and just where he would go from here if he isn't able to overcome Volkanovski. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I'm not sure I believe I believe in his decline, but here's the thing. I don't think he wins. Now, for folks who may not know, he had told the media this week that the first time he saw his coaches was when he got on the plane to fly out to Abu Dhabi, meaning he didn't see them at all during the last couple of months because Hawaii's lockdown measures to battle the coronavirus was so stringent that they had gone to the gym, they would have been arrested. And he said he had to train over Zoom. Now, is he saying that because if he doesn't, he'll get in trouble with local authorities? I don't know. I tend to think he's probably exaggerating a little bit, but here's the reality. The problem with Volkanovski's game is this. Not that I'm some genius or something, far from it, but I've talked to a lot of folks who have helped me understand it. And the conclusion I came to was, if you don't have somebody who holds your hand that way to show you exactly what he's doing, his game won't necessarily wow you. But to those folks in the know, he has what I like. Understand something. It's hard to land on a good fighter, right? You can throw punches. They'll just dodge or block or slip or something. There's bite down on the mouthpiece types, but I mean the high-level ones. You can't just swing and hit them. It's very, very difficult. So how do you do it? You have to trick them. You have to trick him with camouflage. You have to trick him by going one way and then go the other. I mean, all kinds of different stuff. And in terms of that trickery and camouflage and concealment and misdirection, Volkanovski is just ahead of everyone at 145 pounds, including but not limited to Max Holloway. There is a gap in skill between them. It's why Max Holloway, for most of that first fight, not all of it, but most of it, just spent time looking at him. Because he didn't know what he was looking at. And who can blame him? It takes even the best minds in MMA to sort of piece together after the fact. Those guys in City Kickboxing, They are a force to be reckoned with. Make no mistake about it. They are well ahead of the MMA curve when it comes to feinting and trickery and all the stuff that I'm indicating here. So here's the thing I don't like about this fight. I think Max Holloway has the skills to make up that difference, but not in 6 months and not in the middle of a pandemic. Their last fight was against each other. The best rematches are when there's a year or 2 years apart where you can get time to make up the difference. I just don't like Max's chances here. Now, the pandemic could change things. Maybe, you know, Volkanovski hasn't changed or trained properly, and who the hell knows? But all things being equal, this is absolutely Volkanovski's fight to lose. I don't think Max is in decline. I just think he met somebody better than him, and that's a different challenge altogether.
Well, personally, I hope you're wrong, because Max is a friend of the show, and he gave us chocolate once, so, yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, no. This is the other part about it. Everything you say about Max is true. He is a gentleman. He's a good representative of this community, and people like him, and not without accident. And I know he has been a great Hawaiian friend to the people of Canada, and it's an amazing thing. I get it. But the thing is, I just wonder a little bit if we're letting how much we like Max as a person cloud our judgment about how talented Volkanovski is.
Oh, I know I am. There's no illusions on my part, for sure. Luke, appreciate the time. Thanks for doing this, man.
Thanks, guys.